Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play. Today we'll be featuring a talk from our 2018 Youth Sports Summer Summit, available at full of forloveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, and sports leaders develop programs to ensure kids love the game more at the end of a season than they did at the beginning. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Thanks for joining us for our inaugural For the Love of the Game Digital Summit. I've had the opportunity now to speak to so many amazing people. Our next guest is another one of those amazing people. I got to meet about 3 years ago when we first did our Changing the Game project speaker training, and have gotten to know him quite well since that point, and look forward to see him again face-to-face when we connect at the Way of Champions conference. Mm-hmm. His name is James Leith. He is the owner and founder of Unleash the Athlete, which is an organization he founded as he had to leave his former role as the head of leadership for IMG Academy due to a family emergency, and has played football all the way through to the collegiate level and even some semi-pro football, and now has worked with some amazing athletes and also works with coaches and some parent interactions. So, James, thanks for joining us on this, and I appreciate you doing this in your hectic schedule.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
All right. So before I go into the current, maybe you could share a little bit about, because the whole premise of the summit is for the love of the game. People are passionate about sport, but your childhood, as you grew up, what were the sports you were involved with, and what were some of the activities that you enjoyed as before you got to the collegiate level?
Yeah, I like that question because it's a little different than the experiences they have these days, in that it was the norm back when I was in grade school and high school to just play whatever sport your school offered. And so we had flag football, we had a basketball, and then we had actually a slow pitch softball. So I did that 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And I also played some tackle football. When I got to high school, I just went from sport to sport, and I just lived with my father. And so my father said I either needed to be involved in a sport or I needed to be having a job. And I didn't want to work, because in 8th grade, I had a paper out, and I, you know, that paid for a lot of stuff, but I just wanted to play. And so I just went from sport to sport. So I ended up getting a varsity letter in 7 sports when I was in high school, just going from E2. I wasn't great at most of them, but I had a good attitude. I worked hard. I knew my role, especially playing volleyball. I went out for the volleyball team my senior year, and they were amazing. And I didn't think I was going to make it. But I ended up making a team only because when I was there, I would beat them in sprints and it would make them run harder. And the coach would be like, I want you on the team. Just know you're terrible. But
great boost of confidence.
Well, it was funny because when I saw the list, I brought the list into his room. I was like, hey, you must have made a mistake. He's like, no, I didn't make a mistake. But he said, I want you on the team, not because of your ability to play, but your ability to influence everybody. And so I realized really quickly, okay, my role is not to actually go out on the court. My role is to work hard at practice. And by the end of the year, I got better. And, you know, you work hard and stuff. But like I said, I just went from sport to sport. Football was the one that I really enjoyed. I really excelled at. I went and walked on the college level. And later on in life, I played some semi-pro and some arena ball. But all those experiences playing sports that I wasn't good at, I had opportunity to learn from coaches. And so from a young age, I actually wanted to coach. I had dreams of being in the NFL, just like every other young boy who plays football at a young age. But I really loved coaching. And so I got to pull all the good habits and bad habits from all the males and females that poured into me throughout my youth. And I put that to work now when I'm working with coaches or when I'm, you know, coaching my own team.
That almost, and can skip to the question that I normally ask later. But from that, the good, what were the bad aspects of coaching that you avoid? And then what are the good ones that you try to incorporate now?
Okay. It's a pretty loaded question to start.
I'll do it in 2 questions. You kind of set it up, right?
Yeah, totally.
And I've done the same thing. We all kind of try to take the best qualities of the coaches we had, and I had many. I actually don't remember a lot of bad, like you see now, but I don't have that experience. But maybe just, what was your take on it, like that you've incorporated in your coaching practices now?
I noticed that at a young age that when a coach got frustrated at the team, that sometimes it wasn't actually the team's fault. It was the coach's inability to communicate. And so instead of being able to say, I don't really understand, know how to communicate this, it comes out as aggression. The frustration is at the coach's personal self, at the man or woman in the mirror, instead of the actual team, but it comes out as aggression towards the team.
Right.
So, and I had coaches that did that. And later on, when I became a teacher at the school that I went to, I became friends with my former coaches. And that's always an awkward conversation. I'm like, hey, what's up, coach? And I'm like, hey, you can call me Gene. I'm like, nah, coach. But I got to level with them. I'm like, hey, you know, you've evolved as a coach. You're older, you're wiser. You were kind of a jerk when I was here. Why have you changed? The experience that these wrestlers are having now is different than what I had. And right. So I'll be not offended by that. And he's like, not at all. He's like, here's what happened. And so he went to a conference and he saw that his inability to communicate was actually inhibiting his ability to coach. And so he went to work on himself. He went to work on his ability to use different phrases and motivate different ways and to not treat everybody with a paintbrush, and everybody's going to get treated the same. And he decided, okay, I'm going to treat everybody the way they need to be treated in order to bring the best out of them. So I was like, wow, I'm glad you found that now. Like, it would have been great if you'd have done that. Well, you know, now he learned from his ways. And I think a lot of coaches go through that phase. I mean, when I first started, I was loud and yelling and throwing my clipboard and all this other stuff that young coaches do. And I got it out of my system, and I grew from that. You know, you don't want to see that 10 years later, you're still throwing a clipboard. That's no growth. You maybe have grown the playbook, but you haven't grown yourself. And your athletes need an evolved adult to learn from as a model.
Yeah, and you nailed that on the head in terms of the role model. Ironically, I was coaching my son's blast ball hockey game last night, and the team that was on, I'll call it the ice, but I always say the ice, but it's ball hockey, so it's cement. They were 6-year-old kids. So, and all, usually when you get that age group, you have 4 or 5 coaches on the bench because everybody steps up to put their hand up. And they were just screaming at the top of their lungs. And these kids were playing full, and I'm just like, wait a minute. Because after 25 years, I've kind of learned that it's all about letting these kids play, right? And being positive and a role model, all that kind of stuff. But it's hilarious. And you see that with so many coaches that get in. They kind of do what they did, or they either the coaches that they had, or they don't know any better. So they don't really know to check their emotions at the door. So it's kind of interesting that you share that. So
Well, as I say, and the bad coaches, I think you can sum it up is that bad coaches treat kids like they're mini adults. And the reason why that's bad is because kids are not mini adults. They don't have the emotional experience, just the life experience of knowing that coach is being sarcastic. Doesn't mean he doesn't like me. It just means he's joking. But then the kid shuts down, and now the coach is like, all right, well, if you're going to shut down, I'm out of here. It's like, wait a minute, hold on. They're acting that way because you were sarcastic, but they don't understand sarcasm because they're 8. And so they're not a mini adult. And if you treat them like a mini adult, then you're failing them as an adult. That's our job. Our job as coaches is to make adults. Like, our job as teachers, our job as parents, is we are training them to be adults. And so the best coaches, like, you know, the bad ones did that, but the best ones were great models of people. They didn't have to know the game. I was talking with a friend yesterday on his podcast about he's coaching lacrosse. He never played lacrosse. And he said, how do I become more credible with my lacrosse players? To don't pretend that you know a bunch about lacrosse, because they're going to sniff out that you're not being authentic.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is just be honest with them. Be like, guys, everything I've learned about lacrosse, I've learned from watching you and watching YouTube. That's it. Like, those are the things that I've learned. However, I'm working really hard to make sure you do the fundamentals.
Yeah.
When it comes to years of strategy, I don't have that, but I care and I'm here. Kids are like, good. We're good with that.
Yeah. No, and you precursor the next question. How important it is for coaches to not just care, because that's the characteristic of the greatest coaches, but to connect with their players?
if you can't connect to the player, then they'll never know that you care. You can love a player all day long, but if you speak to them in a condescending way, they're not going to know that you actually love them. They're going to see that you work late into the night making sure that you're watching game film and you're preparing them, because all they know is how you make them feel when they get to practice.
So for my dealing with the athletes, and I know that you did a lot of this work in at IMG, and I believe it's the new extension of what you're doing now. What are they saying that they're looking for in terms of the top qualities from their coaches, and what engages them?
It's what they want to be seen. You know, they want to be heard. Just when I'm talking to my coach, is she paying attention to me? You know, is she taking off her glasses? She's putting her phone away. You know, when I'm out there playing, is my coach paying attention to what I'm doing? Not just to yell at me, you know, but to hey, you did a good job. I like that. That was really good. You should keep doing that. Like, the kids want to be seen, and they know when a coach is going through the motions, or when the playbook is so complex that the coach doesn't have time to care about the kids, because they're busy with their PowerPoints and all this other stuff, where the kids are just like, hey, can we just play? Can we just have some fun? Like, can you just, you know, make sure I'm doing the fundamentals right? And maybe instead of yelling at me for missing that goal, let me know that, oh, you know what? Your weight was on your other foot. Try this. Oh, you made it. Okay, good. Instead of, I can't believe you missed it. Oh God, you did it again. You know, like, the kid's like, well, I did what again? Why don't you tell me, coach? You know, are you a critic or are you a coach? Like, tell me what I did wrong.
Yeah, a dictator versus a facilitator. So is this all the way up to the, like, at IMG, they're pretty high-level athletes. They're all, mm-hmm. many of them I know, are potential pro candidates. So yeah. Same analogies from those athletes as it would be, say, from the 8 to 10 to 12-year-olds in youth sports?
Well, it's a human characteristic. It's not so much age. You look on social media, on Facebook, and you've got adults who are just, they want to be seen. They want to be heard. They have a platform. And so it's not much different when I'm talking. So I don't necessarily like wearing glasses when I'm coaching, because I just want to be free. But what happens is when you wear sunglasses and one of your kids comes and talks to you and you take those sunglasses off, that does something to the kid. Like, oh my gosh, there's the eyes. Like, they're looking at me. Like, it's just me. I'm not hiding behind anything. And then you take a knee, and now you're like eye level with them, and you're talking to them. You're making such a big connection. But you can do the same thing with adults. You know, be careful. If you take a knee in front of someone, that might mean completely different things, right? But you want to take your glasses off. Like, if you come and talk to me and I take my glasses off, I'm like, hey, what's up, Glenn? How you doing? It's like, oh my gosh, James sees me. And there's a connection there. And so it doesn't matter the age when you're talking about connecting to a human. You know, you go about it a different way. I wouldn't talk to an 8-year-old the same way I talk to you. You know, you change the vocabulary, but you're still putting energy into that communication, into that thing. And so whether it's a senior at IMG who's going to go to Alabama and play football, or a 7th grader at the school down the street who just thinks that they want to play some tennis, you look at them, you got to connect with them in the very, very same way. And they just want to be seen regardless of their talent level.
Yeah. And the taking off the sunglasses is a big one for me, because they want to see the eyes, because that's the nonverbal. That's the part of the communication where you can see what's going on. And from a hockey standpoint, which is a lot of the coaches that I interact with now, that even though I'm branched out to a whole bunch of other sports, when you put those skates on, and if you're already 6'2" or 6'4", I had an assistant coach one time, he was 6'7", former basketball player, put the skates on, he's like 7 feet tall on skates, and we're coaching 8-year-old kids that are, you know, maybe 4 feet. And I kept telling him, you gotta get down on your knee. And he looked at me and go, what are you talking about? You gotta get down on your knee. And even I would do it painfully so, because you gotta look in their eyes. They have to be able to see you. You can't be standing there like the Jolly Green Giant And then, you know, it's not going to accomplish anything. You're not connecting with those kids, and they're not going to be able to relate to you.
Yeah. And the kids look up all day long. They're like,
yeah. And they're just like, and they're kind of in awe. And then he also had a tendency to talk. And like at a drill, he'd explain, he'd be up there for, you know, 2-3 minutes. I'm like, let's do the drill and just do it, change on the fly. So these are all the learning things that we as coaches, and you don't even think about it in some respects, but the eye contact to me, that's key. And I know Reed does a lot of talk on that as well. And it's just one of those things that it's an oversight for some, but it's really important to establish that connection. So what are some other important things? I know you've got that great analogy about the avatar in terms of the see me. So maybe expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. In the movie, I love that movie Avatar, where instead of saying, I love you, they say, I see you. And that it just so deep to be able to be seen when the kid is up on the diving board. It's like, Dad, watch me dive. Watch me. And I have a story where when I was coaching a sixth grade girls basketball team, and there's this girl, biggest girl on my team, the tallest girl, and she was afraid to shoot. And I finally asked her, I was like, why don't you shoot? Like, you got the ball, shoot it. She's like, well, my coach last year told me I wasn't allowed to shoot because I always made it. I wanted to say, who is he? I'm going to punch him in the face. I said, okay, you know what? Hey, here's a new thing, Cameron. When you're on this team and you have the ball and you're in the key, I just want you to throw it up there. She's like, what if I miss? I go, I didn't say make it. I said, I want you to throw it up there. And if you throw it up there, I'm going to be happy. She's like, really? I'm like, yeah. So Saturday comes, she's dribbling down. She passes it, passes it back to her, and she passes it back to Tasha, and Tasha shoots it. It's like, ah, so close. Next time she comes down, well, she finally shoots it and she misses, but she turns around to look at me. And I always sit down at the games at sixth graders. Like, I don't need to be up and yelling and stuff. Like, that's ridiculous. Yeah. So I'm sitting down, but she shoots, misses the rim completely. The other team gets the ball. They're running back. She turns around directly and looks at me. I'm up like this. Keep doing it. Keep doing that. You're good. You're going to make it. So yeah. She missed the three. Then she went on this like 14 point, like just run. And she scored more points than anybody. And we won. And she just wanted to be seen. Like, regardless if she won or if she made it or not, she turns and she's like, boom. And I'm like, keep doing that. Because we have to celebrate the attempt and don't just celebrate the result. Because the attempt, if they keep doing it and they see that the coach has faith in them, that builds confidence in them. And so you want to be able to see, but you also want to be let them know that, like, hey, I care about you. But that's how you can show that you care about
them. Yeah, it's the same analogy. And it ties totally into that whole growth mindset, you know, praising the effort versus the result itself. And it kills me when I see coaches and a kid will make a mistake in a game. It really kills me when I see them criticize a kid in a practice, because that's where they really should be making ugly, ugly, ugly mistakes. And the uglier, the better, because they develop the creativity. And then when they, like, if a kid falls and they looks at me, same thing. It's like, thumbs up. That's okay. Keep going. Or in a game, you know, if you made a mistake and like the girl where that they turned and they went and scored the ball, it's learn from that mistake, number one. Secondly, it's okay, we'll get it back. And look what you end up doing. That confidence just end up going like this, a lot of part of the game. And too many coaches think it's all about criticizing that mistake, but it actually should be encouraging them to make those mistakes.
I got it with the encouragement, make mistakes. Some coaches are going to watch this thing and say, oh, well, you can say that because, you know, winning's not important to some people. Like, that's not what we're talking about. There's a time and a place that, you know, on a 2-hour practice, minute 37, someone takes a bad shot. If you want to ream them, you've just lost them for the rest of practice.
Yep.
But in that opportunity, you can be like, okay, why'd you take that shot? Like, let's understand what the kids saw. Like, what did they do? Because maybe they actually saw something you didn't see. But there's probably a better chance that they just took a crappy shot. Well, now you can talk about that. Because in a game, you can't really talk about it. But when it happens in a game, and now I'm talking from an American football perspective, where I've been in situations where I made a mistake and I was playing and coach took me out. And I was just like, man, this sucks. Like, I made a mistake. And so I learned from that. And now when I coach and somebody makes some dumb mistake, I'll call them to the sideline. I'll meet them halfway. I'll be like, hey, do you know what you did wrong? And if they're like, no, and I'm like, okay, well, come out, let me tell you. But if they're like, yeah, I went to the wrong gap. I'm like, okay, are you good? I'm good. Okay. Get back in there. And now they go back in there. But what happens is, like, I just built that relationship with them. Now they trust me a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I'm trusting them. And I didn't need to ream them. And I tell you what, I've done that a few times where parents will come up to me and they're like, I really appreciate you didn't take out my child. And I'm like, I just want you to know I didn't do that for you. I did that for them. But thank you for noticing that. Like, I'm trying to build confidence that you're going to fail and win, because only one team wins. Both teams can't win. And the other team who didn't win, they failed, technically. That's the point, is to win.
Yeah. Well, you just touched on the next part of it, because the –
I'm like writing this interview. Like, it's like I almost
knew
all the questions.
I'm like, yeah, well, I kind of figured it would got to go this way because we're in the same space. That was the whole, you know, we talked about the connection, and now we've talked about that whole, like the caring component is as part of the C's. What do you feel about that in terms of, because there's four C's. Well, there's the big three, which is the caring, the connection, and the confidence. We touch on the confidence. We touch on the connection. Let's talk on building character and the importance for coaches to care. So give some examples on that front.
I'm a little confused. What do you mean?
Okay, so transformational coaching, which is kind of where we're basically been talking about. You've touched on two of the four C's, right? Okay. The importance for connection and they being able to see you. The importance for developing that confidence in their play. So the other two, with developing character and importance for coaches to care about their players. So maybe let's talk about character. How do you develop
character?
I love
talking about character. So
let's talk about character.
Yeah, when it comes to character, I think the misunderstanding of character is that it can be taught. A character isn't taught. You can talk about character, but character is caught. Character comes from me looking at my coach, seeing that there was a bad call, and then learning how to respond to that bad call. And so if I'm a coach of a 10-year-old baseball team and a bad strike is called and I lose my mind in the dugout and I come storming out, that's the character that I'm teaching my kids.
Yep.
They're watching. Now, I mean, that's really, I mean, it doesn't get more black and white than that. More simple than that is that's how I'm teaching. I was a freshman in high school. I remember this just right now. And one of my favorite babysitters, actually, he ended up being the coach of the other team. And I always really respected him. And something happened where he actually got tossed out of the game. And I was just so embarrassed because I respected him. And when I talked to him afterwards, and I was like, what happened? He's like, oh, I lost my cool. And I was like, it's a freshman baseball game. Even back then, I was like, why? Like, it didn't matter. But I learned I could have either acted like him or I decided not to act like them. And so when I taught character at IMG and what I do with Unleash the Athlete is that I give them examples. Like, here's a very smart Twitter profile. This is somebody who is going to get offered a scholarship because of their talent, but also because of the kind of person that they are online. They're sharing other people's stuff. They're sharing in victories. They're, you know, hey, great game. I work a lot in the online gaming space, the professional gaming space. And when somebody does something good and they get beat, like if you and I are playing something and you beat me and I send GG in a text to you, that means good game. That's like tipping the hat, you know, or shaking hands after the game. It's GG. Yep. But if I don't send that to you, now there's beef. Now we've got a problem because I didn't do that. And so I would show them, like, here's somebody who never does GG to one of my younger gamers, or here's someone that always does it. And you can see that there's you have this reputation. And so as adults, we are always modeling what our kids are going to do. I get phone calls from previous athletes from 10 years ago. And whenever they call, they never want to talk about the game. Championship, the practice. The last guy I talked to, his name is Maddie. I brought this up, I think, a couple months ago at a conference. Was he goes, hey, do you still teach the handshake? And I was like, yeah, I teach it on the first day of practice, no matter what sport, what age. I teach them how to shake hands, introduce themselves. And he goes, well, I do that every match wrestling. And I win the match many times before it even happens because I don't let him give me a crappy handshake. And I was like, he goes, I go. And he, by the way, he's like top three in the nation right now as a senior year in college. He goes and he shakes hand, and then, and he's on the phone with me. He goes, I go and shake their hand. If they give me a weak handshake, I go, shake it like a, and then I squeeze it. I said, Maddie, I'm so proud of you. That's great. However, I'm still your coach and I need you to stop saying, shake it like a man. He's like, I don't understand. I go, that supposes that a woman can't have a strong handshake.
Yeah.
So why don't you change it to shake it like you mean it? He's like, oh, coach, I love that. My girlfriend's going to love that too. Like, you know, so it's, so you're, what does Jerry say? He's like, your influence is never neutral, right? Like I still had influence over Maddie. And I took that opportunity 10 years removed from being his coach to just making that thing I taught him 10 years ago just a little bit better. And that's character. Like that's going to improve Maddie's character because now he's like, okay, I don't want to disrespect women unintentionally. Never did it intentionally, but he's like, okay, I could see how that could be, you know, shrewd as bad.
And then that's the main focus of what you're working on now is character development. Or what are, and you're talking about the gamers and then the gaming community. And it was kind of what was fascinating that that's an area that you're also working on. How big is that realm and how fast is it growing? Because I've come across some data that's kind of blowing my mind. I just want you to share some insight on the whole e-gaming community.
So if anybody's watching this and they're a leadership coach, a mental coach, some kind of doctor, like esports is hiring. Like it's blowing up. To give you an example, there was a Call of Duty tournament a couple months ago in Atlanta, and someone told me like they had more views online than like one of the games of the World Series the year previous. But nobody, like adults, ignore it because they think it's silly. Problem is that sponsors aren't ignoring it. Money is not ignoring it, and there's behind on the other side of this wall right here, I've got a team playing a game called Dota. And if they qualify today or tomorrow, they're going to go play for a $10 million prize in a couple months, which is just crazy. And they're splitting that between five people. So the money is there and the gamers are making anywhere between $50,000 to $500,000 a year. So they brought me in to translate all the sports psychology stuff that I have my master's in performance psychology to do that. Also like physically train them to teach them how to eat, to teach them how to live. But ultimately what I have found in the online gaming community is that there's a lack of social awareness, how to be in certain situations, especially a conflict resolution. And so a lot of things that I taught at IMG and I continue to teach in communication, just how to handle conflict. What happens when you and your teammate are upset at each other? How do you talk to your coach when you think you should be playing more? Do you go and be like, why am I not playing? Or do you go and you say, what can I do to play more? Those are two very, very different conversations. And one of them, the coach will be like on edge and be like, wait a minute, like, okay, are we going to argue about this? Or then, you know, when you say, coach, what can I do? The coach is going to tell you, well, you need to stop being late to practice and you need to get some rest at night so that way you're not so sluggish. Do those things. I think you're going to do all right, but it won't happen overnight. And so I teach the gamers how to have these personal relationships because as a gamer, like you're playing all by yourself for a long time.
Pretty much,
so it's really challenged me to like think about intentionally teaching how to have a relationship with someone, like a friendship with somebody or how to communicate with somebody without being sarcastic or condescending or just like being a know-it-all.
Well, I had it is exploding. It's funny. I first learned about it. Kind of like you said, the adults really don't really know how big it's become. I didn't know I don't play the video games. My son plays video games, but I had a co-op student that worked with me last summer and supposedly he was ranked. As he said, at one point he was like ranked number 9 in the world in FIFA, probably 14 or whatever. He said, yeah, it was crazy. Like, and then goes the kind of money now that's part of this, the endorsements. And I came across an article that even the Olympics are considering it, making some form of e-games part of the summer games as an Olympic event where it'd be a medal event. And I'm kind of torn on that front because I don't see it as the raw amateur athletics, especially if there's all the endorsements and the professional. That's where I get torn with the Olympics. But Maple Leaf Entertainment said that these events are selling out like in minutes, faster than rock concerts, faster than, you know, and you referenced the World Series. So where do you see it going? Like how big do you think the e-games phenomenon is going to be?
Well, behind the scenes with big time decision makers, I'm in Dallas and I currently work for Complexity, which is the team owned by Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. And so we give you an idea of how big it is. Yesterday, I played Call of Duty with Post Malone, who is a big time rapper, and Ezekiel Elliott, who is the running for the Cowboys. And like they just wanted to play Call of Duty with our professional gamers. And so we made it happen. And so we're sitting there, we're playing, you know, Cole Beasley is in there, all these Cowboys are in there. And it's just like, that's what these guys want to do. But the people with all the money are calling it year one for esports. Online gaming has been around for a long time. Video games have been around for a long time. But the idea that these playing video games is a sport, it's a very hard concept to swallow.
Yeah.
Unless you say something like they're cognitive athletes. Because playing, so for the tournament that they're going to be qualifying for in a couple minutes or in a couple hours, is they have to play for 6 hours straight. And they have to mentally be there for 6 hours. They can't check out. If you check out, your team loses. And so the endurance, the what the body goes through, so I do a lot of like lifting with them and stretching and yoga and proper nutrition. So I've swayed to the other side where it's like, okay, I could see how this is an athletic endeavor. It's not a collision sport or contact sports, none of that stuff, but you do have to be in top mental shape. And so it's very interesting, but the teamwork stuff, the building, the bonding, the character of who you are, all that stuff matters when we're talking contracts, when we're talking sponsorships. Somebody says something on stage, if they lose and they hit the chair, they get dropped from the team. They go from making $150,000 a year to nothing. And so they bring in Complexity, brought in a guy like me who can teach them to kind of channel those aggressions when maybe they've never learned that because they didn't learn it in traditional sports, where you and I, we learned that if I don't like this guy that I'm playing with, I got to figure out how to do it. I got to figure out how to work with them. But in esports, if I don't like this guy, I hit the reset button. He's on the other side of the world. I never have to play with him again.
Yeah.
Until he's on his team or her team, because there's female teams as well.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see how it's exploding, how quietly it's exploding. And as I've started doing the research and I've interacted with a lot of the millennials, you know, the 20 somethings that are really, really involved. And the big one is the fan base, like how fast these events are selling out because X, Y, and Z, like top players are coming and they're doing a live event. There's a picture I shared in one of my presentations from Japan. It's like minutes show up and there's like 20,000 people going to watch this in a, like a Coliseum as if they were watching like a hockey or a soccer or a baseball game.
They're chanting. I've gone to events that if I didn't work in the organization, I wouldn't have been able to get tickets. There's thousands of people at the events.
It's just amazing. So that in itself is a complete different thing. We could probably talk about an hour about it. So you talk about the teamwork and the culture and all that stuff that we learn through sport that they're not getting because of a lot of individual, they're doing the online stuff. Right. How important is it for, are there parents involved in the esport gaming thing versus the traditional youth sport, community sport, and so, or yes that, or no?
I like that question because I do not miss parents at all. In the esport community, it's pretty much the kid is if they can play, then they can play. I mean, we have a 16-year-old who is on one of our teams and he plays remotely, but that's probably the thing I miss the least about coaching traditionally. Because I don't deal with parents very much. Now I still do UTA and I still volunteer coach. So I'm dealing with those parents, you know, they can't get away from them. But in the esport world, no, it's, you've got to cut for yourself. And so I do very much appreciate that about the esport world. I'll be honest.
And one of the things about the reasons why kids play video games to begin with is there are no parents traditionally over their head watching and or screaming if they made a mistake, or coaches doing the same thing. There's no officials enforcing the rules. They make their own rules. So it's their ownership. They own that experience. So translate that to youth sports, where a lot of organizations have clued into that phenomenon and the avatar, which you mentioned in terms of the customer. How do we get the youth sports side to come around full circle and understand it's all about their experience, and how do we make that experience more positive? How do we do that?
Well, I think you saying how do you make it their experience is that's a big deal, because parents, I've noticed, are so afraid that if their child fails, that it will be looked on as the parent's failure and the parent will be accepted by the other parents. So it's one of those, there's a song by Bowling for something, I forget what their name is right now, but it's called High School Never Ends. And it's like Brad Pitt's the quarterback, Jack Black is the Joker, like it never ends. And so now you have parents who are still playing competitive sport, but it's called parenting. And so if little Johnny does something wrong or fails, now all of a sudden as a parent, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm a terrible parent. They're not going to accept me at the PTA meeting and all this other crap that is actual real life. I mean, I call it crap, but it actually happens. Mm-hmm. And so if we had parents, and I've had a few of these over the years, that their kid fails and I let them fail as their coach, but then we build them up. And they're just like, yeah, no, I'm good. But yeah, you need to sit her for the day because of whatever. Okay, cool. You do that. Then there's other parents that are like, look, I know Johnny had a bad day at school, but he should probably still play in the game. What do you think? You know, or if he doesn't, I might have to pull the money that I give to the program. And, you know, me and you and John Sullivan are on the same. It's like, hey, we won't miss you. Peace out. Like, someone else will come in, you know, we'll figure it out. But I think the biggest problem is not that kids aren't participating in sports and all that other crap that people throw out there. It's that parents are participating too much, and they're putting too much of an emphasis on the performance of a six-year-old, and that six-year-old doesn't want to play anymore because the parent keeps yelling at them. But if I'm playing video games, no one's yelling at me. No one's telling me like, oh, you failed, because yeah, I failed. I get another life. I respawn. You
press the reset button.
Right. And the way video games are now these days, you're playing a first person shooter and you die, you respawn right away. I get to try again. Yep. Whereas in real life, if I mess up, now I've got to listen to dad talking to me on the entire way home about how he's so disappointed in me. And like, are you trying to embarrass the family by your performance? Like, well, I'm 10. I'm not thinking about the family. I'm thinking about how, you know, why I got a grape popsicle and not a cherry popsicle, because Tony took the last cherry one and I'm upset about it. Like, I'm not even thinking about the loss, I'm thinking about popsicle, you know,
yeah. Where's the snack?
Adults. And so the kids are sick and the parents are sick, and they're caught in this pattern of, if my son or daughter doesn't do well, then I'm not a good parent, which is total crap, because it's how your kid responds to not doing well that will tell if you're a good parent or not.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like John's analogy, and I've shared it with a lot of people, how youth sports isn't youth sports. It's not kids playing kids anymore. It's more so the adults competing with other adults through their kids. And that's what's really kind of pushed that whole $15 billion industry in the US, and it's trickling into Canada and other markets, where it's become professionalized. And it's so much about that almighty dollar, for one, the marketing, and the kids are being deprived of just the experience of playing a game. Like you and I growing up, we just went and played. Like, there was nobody telling us what to do, how to do it. Just go play. And they're missing that. And we won't get back to the good old days, but somehow, some way, I hope we can find some happy medium where we create that positive environment. So we talked
about, let me comment on that real quick.
What's that?
let me comment on that real quick. We call it the good old days, but we forget that the good old days had coaches who were dictators. So they actually weren't that good. And so the pendulum has swung all the way over here. It's like, now we have to go to practice and we have to make sure that my son isn't yelled at because he can't handle being yelled at. Mm. Now, now Johnny's never been yelled at. So then he becomes an adult and he gets a boss, and the boss is actually kind of a jerk. And the reason that Johnny wants to quit his job is because he's never been yelled at. And his boss is like, you did it wrong. You cost us some $5 million with this proposal. Like, I can't believe you did this. And Johnny's freaking out because no one's ever put any adversity in his life. And he's like, I don't know how to handle this. So then he quits. And we don't realize that we didn't allow Johnny to overcome adversity when he was younger. So how can he possibly learn how to overcome adversity when he's an adult, when everybody thinks that he already should know that? And so when we remove adversity from our kids, whether it's in school, whether it's in a sport, we take away from them the ability to learn how to cope with that disappointment. It's a coping skill. And we come up with coping mechanisms because we never learned the coping skill. And so we use sports as a vehicle to teach emotional maturity. Need to write that down. That was pretty good.
I'll give you credit for that one. Yeah, pat on the back. You know, but emotional maturity.
Like, we need parents and coaches and teachers to realize that sports is a way to teach emotional maturity. It's a way to teach how to cope with disappointment, how to win with dignity, how to lose with dignity, how to just be a nice human being so that you can grow up and make more great human beings.
Yeah, it's, you know, we've shared that many years ago. It was Jerry that actually shared the anecdote when he sat on the stool for the first conference, how important it is that coaches don't make a living. It's more important that our purpose and our calling is to make a difference by developing youth into adults. And that's really what we do. And 99% of these kids are not going to go on to play, you know, maybe go to the IMGs and get collegiate scholarships and potentially be pro candidates. Our goal hopefully is so that they are active, they continue to be active, and they become great people, well-rounded people. And that's part of the problem is the adversity. If they're not seeing it, how do they become that? There was a study that I came across it's probably 3 or 4 years ago, but they surveyed like over 100,000 students in the U.S. and they were concerned about their health, their mental health particularly. And like over 80% of the respondents said they were extremely overwhelmed with everything they could do. They were sad. They were lonely. But one of the big ones was like 8% of the respondents said they seriously considered committing suicide, which is a real big problem now with today's youth. Because they can't handle adversity, they're not resilient.
They never learned how to cope.
They don't have coping skills.
Mm-hmm. And
you learn them, but where do you learn them now? Like, if you're not able to learn them in sport, where else can you learn them? In school? No, not so much. They're not really.
My team, because I'll let them struggle. Like I've been coaching long enough to let a child struggle. And you know, like I wrote an article 2 years ago that talked about how I was watching this kid at Starbucks try to zip up his jacket. And he was like, Mom, I need you to do it for me. She was like, you can do it. He's like frustrated. And his mom just kept saying, you can do it, honey. And she had her coffee. She was ready to leave. And she was waiting for this moment. She was a superstar mom. Finally, the kid zips up the zipper.
Yeah.
And you get that beautiful moment. He's like, Mom, I did it. She's like, I knew you. And then they left. And I was like, I don't need to see anything else the rest of the day. That's the most beautiful thing I'm going to see. Nothing will top that. Because she knew that he needed to struggle and he needed to overcome it. He wasn't in danger. There's no failure. I mean, if the jacket's broken, she can be like, oh, you know what? Let me fix that because the jacket's broken. And now you zip it up. And it doesn't end as a kid. Like my father, he is in a rec home right now and he's had some strokes and he's older. The only thing he has is his independence. And so he likes pudding. I bring him pudding for lunch every day. And he can't open it by himself. But if I start it and I give it to him, the sense of pride on his face that he can open up his pudding is worth the 30 minutes it took for me to drive there to give it to him. And so it's not just kids, but like we all need to have ownership of the things that we do. And if we rob our kids of any kind of ownership or any kind of adversity, where else are they going to get it? And so you think about like kids are doing video games. It's like, well, video games offer adversity because you get beat and then you have to start over. So there's some great things in that. And then if someone has a child who's playing video games, instead of just dismissing it, ask them, be like, show me what you're doing. And there's, oh, you know, I'm having a hard time doing level 9. Oh, show me, I want to watch. Now you have something to talk about.
Yeah.
And it could be a very beautiful moment. But we're, as parents, I'm not seeing them talk about overcoming adversity. I'm seeing them talk about, oh, you guys are losing. Man, that sucks. Or you guys won. Yeah, that's awesome. Let's go have ice cream. It's like, hold on, let's have a conversation of the journey. Why are we always talking about the result? The result doesn't matter. Who cares?
Well, you can also learn a ton through losing. Right.
Yeah.
And what I've watched it like on my ball hockey team this year, we won, tied a couple of games. We came close to winning a couple of games, but the rest of them, we struggled like 2-3 goals. We didn't have a goalie. Like the way this organization was really, it was really weird. Like only 2 of the 6 teams had goalies. So we ended up, you know, losing games, not because we were not a great team, but we didn't have somebody that was their position. So beginning of the season, they were really bitter with each other. They were beating each other up. They were, and I kept saying, hey guys, you know, you got to ease up on the criticism. I don't tolerate that. But, and amazingly, the last 5 games, they were like a team. They were just like, you know, they were okay with the fact that, okay, we lost by a couple of goals, but the adversity was something they overcame throughout the course of the season. That whole forming, storming, norming, performing concept in the group formation, you nail it on the head. We're missing that and we're not getting there, but how do we get there when you've got everybody's expectations all become about the money, the academies, they're costing so much money, the travel teams, it's all about the money. Like I get it. I get the fact that parents have high expectations, but shifting the corner to the good parents, like the ones that are the silent majority, the 95 or even more percent, they truly, truly love their kids. They truly want the best for their kids. They're the ones that are kind of like caught in this conundrum where they see the parents that are acting up in the stands or taking a little bit, or even coaches that kind of push it over the top. What kind of tips can we share for them so that, and then for the coaches, so they can engage parents to make the youth sports experience better in terms of change?
You got to set the expectations at the very beginning and you have to stick to those boundaries. And so if you have a parent meeting, you got to let them know, look, we are in a very competitive league and it's important that we win because if we don't win, I could lose my job. So I'm going to a coach accordingly. So I need your support in that. And then there's other times where you're like, hey, this isn't a competitive league. This is rec ball. And so we may lose some games because of some, what you think are questionable calls, but I need to get everybody in. And so if you need a more competitive league, you should remove your child from my team because I'm not going to define success by the scoreboard. I'm going to define success by your child being able to dribble basketball, to be able to pass, to be able to lose with dignity and be able to win with dignity, all these other things. And so you set those expectations up at front. But then also you set up some other boundaries. I don't talk to parents for 24 hours after a game, win or lose. I don't talk to them. I don't want to talk to them. The emotions are too high or they're fake. One, and we're just sweeping problems under the rug. You want to talk about it? You can text me all you want, but I will not respond for 24 hours because you just got to calm down. The other thing is I never talk about playing time without the student standing right next to me. Because if a parent's like, I want to know why Stacy's not playing, I'm like, okay, cool. Stacy, come here. Stacy, why don't you think you play very much? And she'll be very honest. I don't try very hard at practice. Okay. Thanks, homie. That's why your kid's not playing. Can you leave me alone, please? Like, you know, so every time the kid will say that. Or if the parent's like, oh, I don't want them to be over here. I'm like, okay, I invite you to come to practice. Don't let your child see you, but come and observe them at practice. You tell me why they're not. Might not be skill. It might just be they're too young or they're scared. I mean, I've had football players, parents come up to me and be like, why'd you take so-and-so out of the game? I'm like, do you want me to be honest? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, he came up and told me he's scared and he didn't want to play anymore. And so if he's scared in the game of football, it's a collision
sport. He's going to get hurt.
If I have somebody who's scared, he's going to be found and he's going to get drilled by the other team because the other team on him. And so I removed your son from the game. Do you want to talk to him about it, embarrass him, or do you want to, you know, just let it be? And so be very honest with the play, with the parents, and you give yourself about 24 hours to kind of give a buffer, that emotional stuff, especially if they're like, no, I'm not waiting 24 hours. That's when you have to 24 hours, because they're going to try to make threats and all this other stuff. And at the end of the day, I mean, if you coach scared because you're afraid to lose your job, it's just like playing scared. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's going to happen. And just know that as a coach, you can do everything perfect. They'll still throw you out. I mean, that's it. You got it. Someone's got to be the scapegoat. And if it's going to be the coach, then sure, it's the coach.
Yeah. My perfect example, Toronto Raptors. They don't get past the LeBron James, and they was going to the final, and they fired their coach who got him there. And everybody's kind of like, hang on a sec, wait a minute. You know, how do you fire a coach that has taken that team from where they were to where they are now? And what if they would have fired Barry Trotz last year, because two consecutive years in a row, they win President's Trophy. They can't get past the second round. They can't get past the Penguins. They lose out on the championship because they shifted gears and different culture, different coaches. You're totally right on that front. So we're kind of getting to the rapid fire time. So I got a question that I've been asking everybody. How do we ensure that kids love a sport, love activity more at the end of a season than they did at the beginning of the season? What kind of insight can you share?
I think worry about the experience more than the playbook. That make sure that they are excited to come to practice, that they are challenged, that the drills are changed up. You know, they're not so monotonous. Outside of fundamental drills, every sport has fundamental drills that you have to do, but you can still get creative in doing that. Be interested in what the kids are interested in. For example, you go to practice and you do this, kids are going to freaking love you. Because that's what they're doing, and you're an old guy, and you're doing.
Hang on a sec. You've buffered. Like, do that again, because it's frozen in time.
When you do that in front of the kids, they're just like, "You're such a nerd." Thanks, coach. That was awesome. Like little simple things, especially if you're like that big coach you're talking about, that 7-foot guy, and he's just always like. And all of a sudden he busts out with something like that. And he's like, that can just funk. So be more interested in the experience that the athletes are having than you are in how fat your playbook is. Yeah. You're going to find that the kids are going to enjoy it a little bit more.
I agree. I mean, the big thing, I guess the greatest piece of advice I got many, many years ago from who became a mentor of mine, not just for hockey, but also for softball, because we co-coach together, was keep it simple. Like, sports can be, you know, it's really the team that executes all the simple things right, the little things. Those are usually the teams that win. If you throw too much at these kids, they're just going to get overwhelmed, and they're going to, hey, we're going to work. You know, like, we don't need 700 plays on a football team. I think of my football teams that won the provincial championship, which is equivalent to state. I think we had 20 plays, and we just executed them extremely well, and no one could stop us. We didn't need a 400-play playbook, and the coaches recognized that, and they brought us to, you know, to win the provincials. So, okay, rapid-fire questions.
The small, because if you can perfect 10 plays, you can make up stuff in the huddle, because they understand those 10 plays so well. You can go, hey, we're going to run sweep left, except this time, Tony, you're going to go to the right. Cool. Everybody else do the exact same thing. Break. And then they go do it, and it's a completely different play, but because they all knew it, you know, it works. And so I always go simple, and then build off of simple instead of complex and try to make it more simple.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, even when I'm coaching, I usually have 25 drills that are my core drills, and I just spin off the drills, and I usually will name them after the kids.
Always.
So, like, you know, we're going to do Liam's drill because he loves this one, and blah, blah, blah. And then everybody knows what it is, and you don't even have to use a whiteboard. Right. That kills me is when coaches stand up in front of a whiteboard for like, you know, 10 minutes explaining a drill. Well, they should have clued into it because if you know, whatever. So rapid fire questions.
That's a great opportunity to teach a kid how to be a leader.
Exactly. And one of my favorite things I've done and over the years is I've actually had kids run the practice. Mm-hmm. They plan the drills. And it's hilarious. Like how complicated some of these drills they'll come up with. And I started that with 10-year-olds. They're
harder in those drills than any drill you give them.
Yeah, I'm like, what? Okay, you guys want to keep running practices?
Coach, you have veto power, right? Like if it doesn't have anything to do and it's not going to make them better or it's unsafe, you can always say, all right, guys, you can do this, but we need to put this pad over here and you need to run this that way because that's going to be dangerous or whatever.
Yeah, so it was great exercise. So rapid fire questions I've tried to ask. What is your favorite book for coaches?
I've been saying Legacy for a couple of years now by James Kerr. It's written about the All Blacks in New Zealand. I love it because it's very digestible chunks. I think there's 15 rules that they live by. And I just really enjoy that book. So I would definitely say that's a really quick read. I would also recommend if you are coaching 11th graders to find out what they're reading in their English classes, whether it's like Catcher in the Rye, The Great Gatsby, whatever it is, because if you can make references to that during practice and they're reading about it in the English class, something magical happens. It's just kind of fun to be like, oh my gosh, you're talking about Holden Caulfield. Like, yeah, you know how he was kind of a jerk? Well, that's kind of how you're being right now. Like, oh my gosh, that's a great analogy, you know? So if you can understand what they're doing or what video game they're playing or what dance is popular, it's a great way to connect to your students.
Yeah, the book analogy is a perfect one that Phil Jackson used all every year. He would actually give books to every one of his players that would relate to how he got to know them as people. And it was amazing how many times they, like even Michael Jordan had like 9 different books, or I'm not sure how many years he coached him, but every year he was like, how did you know I would like this? Like, you know, just because of the way he connected with each one of his players. So what about,
go ahead.
So there's a little bit of buffering. So sometimes I got to wait for you. What were you saying?
I don't remember.
We'll have to do a little bit of blooper reel on this one. Okay, so a favorite book or recommendation, whether it be a book or resources for parents, because the other cog in the equation, what would you recommend?
I read a book a couple years ago. It was written in 93 by a Jewish child psychologist called The Blessing of a Skinned Knee. And in there, she wrote about how dangerous it is to remove all danger from our kids, that they need to fall down and they need to scrape their knee. They need to touch the pot when it's hot. Like these are things that they need to overcome. And that if they never did any of those things, there's a bunch of examples, but if they never did any of those things, when they do them as an adult,
yep, it's
like life shattering. Like, I can't believe I burned my finger on a pan. Like, how could this ever happen to me? It's like, you're 25 years old. Like, that happens all the time. Like, it's not a big deal. And so I really appreciated that. And it was written in 93. Think about how much worse it is now as far as like, you know, you and I, we rode on the back of a parents' pickup truck for hundreds of miles. We were fine. You know, just wondering what are all these signs saying, trying not to make eye contact with the person behind us. Like, that's where we lived and we turned out okay. And so I think that that book, it would be really good. And then, of course, there's books like by Angela Duckworth called Grit and things like that book that I think are great. But I think that's a good one to start with.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. I watched a woman do a talk. It's called Time to Remove the Bubble Wrap from, and it was at a conference. And I thought it was actually brilliant because the kids do need to scrape their knees. They need to fall down. I remember growing up, like taking my bike and we'd be jumping wraps and we'd fall down and we'd scrape and we'd get. I was fortunate actually that I never broke anything. And you know, some of my buddies did. They went in a cast for 6 weeks. And it healed, and next, you know, just keep going. But unfortunately, today we're so protective of these kids that we're not helping them later, and we need to help them become great people now so that they're great people later and they can flourish in their future. So I agree with that. Okay, so the last kind of a rapid fire question for coaches that are just starting, like literally just getting going, what tip would you share with these coaches to help them shave 5 years off their learning curves?
Study psychology more than you study strategy. Learn how to connect to different students, have experiences that make you a more complete person, go overseas, study teams that do really well that didn't have great resources, but that were really resourceful. Not always having to, I have to get this new batting cage. I have to get that new net or whatever it is. Like if you are a resourceful coach and no matter what level you want to coach at, just be really good at where you're at right now. If you want to be a high school coach, maybe you start a couple years in middle school. You want to be a college coach, like, you know, it's not a bad idea to go and volunteer your time to some college because that's going to get you there. So wherever you're at, if you're trying to coach college football, don't try to be Nick Saban tomorrow.
Right.
Be a graduate assistant, you know, and enjoy that role because eventually when you make a mistake, it might cost you your job. But when you're younger, you make a mistake, you just get yelled at. No big deal. You don't get fired and have to move your family to another state. And so you don't want the high stakes job right away. Make your mistakes when you're younger.
Yeah, that's a great, great tidbit. I actually watched Sean McVay was interviewed by John Gordon on a summit that he put together. And when he was asked that question, you know, early in your career, what was really important? He says, listen and learn and kind of be that fly on the wall and just it'd be a sponge and absorb as much information as you can from those high level coaches. And then, you know, year after year after year, just continue to develop and look where he took the Rams last year at a relatively young age because he listened and learned. Okay. So
yeah, when we first started coaching, you didn't know anything. Like you just finished playing. That doesn't mean you can coach. It just means you can play. You don't know anything. And so, yeah, definitely keep your mouth shut and learn from the people around you.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, and everyone uses the analogy about Wayne Gretzky when he went into coaching. You know, he did okay, but it wasn't really his wheelhouse. He was an amazing player, but just because you're a great player doesn't mean you're going to make a great coach. And most of the greatest coaches of all time never really flourished in the games that they're actually coaching. So it's kind of that oxymoron, right? So what's James going to be working on second half of this year going into 2019 with some of the big projects he got in the works?
I've got some online courses that I'm releasing. I get asked questions pretty often about a few things, leadership development, mental health, and activities to help bond the team. Most activities, for some reason, people are always asking me like, what, you have an activity for this? How does this teach this point? So I'm going to release a course that you can find at jamesleith.com or utathlete.com that is like 60 of my most fun activities that help bond a team, help grow a team, and sometimes just to kind of blow off some steam. And that'll be out in a couple of weeks. Okay. And I'm also kind of speaking all over the place. And you mentioned John Gordon. I just got invited to be one of his premier speakers. So I'll be speaking on John Gordon books and those topics over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I loved his recent summit that he did, and he had a lot of people part of it. Some of the snippets were like 5 minutes, and then some of them were like 2 hours or like an hour. Sean was like, his talk with Sean, I was like, wow, this is great. He's got some amazing work, and kudos to you to get involved with that. That's great. So if any people want to get a hold of you, go on and connect with you in terms of the stuff that you're doing, how do they do that?
Twitter's good, just James Leith. I'm on Twitter. My Instagram, I finally put that on private just because of trolls. So I don't really accept anybody on there. But Twitter is good. And then you can always email me at coach@jamesleith.com.
Perfect. So thanks for making the time out of your crazy schedule. Enjoy your sounds like you got some guys in behind that wall. Are they going to need some of your help as they're getting ready for their next e-game event? And look forward to seeing you at the WAIS Champions Conference and look forward to it. Nice to connect with the team again. I haven't seen a bunch of you guys for a while.
Yeah, it's good to see you, man.
Thanks, James. Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.